You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. If you go to the Sydney airport, immigration control is a cinch as long as you're a citizen of Australia or New Zealand. There's no waiting in line for a stressful one-on-one interview with a border agent. You just walk over to what's called a smart gate, which looks kind of like a walk-through metal detector. You take off your glasses and your hat, and you look into the camera at the smart gate. The camera compares your face to the picture of you in your passport, and it uses facial recognition technology and thinks about it a little bit, and if there's a match, it lets you through the gate. Simple as that. On to baggage claim. But how does it work, and how secure is it? So for the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about facial recognition, how machines do it, what they can, what they cannot do, how they compare to humans at recognizing faces, and we'll be talking about privacy issues too, because, you know, in large cities like New York and London, it's estimated that your face is photographed dozens of times a day just by walking around the city. And now with cameras attached to smartphones, how long is it going to be before someone can snap a picture of you at the supermarket with the smartphone and figure out who you are? Lots of privacy concerns to think about, so let's get right into it. Let me introduce my guests. Alice O'Toole is the director of the Face Perception Research Lab at the University of Texas at Dallas. She's also a professor in the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences there, and she joins us from Cake Mix Recording in Dallas. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Thank you. Jonathan Phillips is an electrical engineer at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, in Washington. He's also program manager at NIST's Multiple Biometric Grand Challenge. He joins us from our studios in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Phillips.
Thank you.
Jim Dempsey is the Vice President for Public Policy at the Center for Democracy and Technology in San Francisco. He joins us from KQED. Welcome back to Science Friday, Mr. Dempsey.
Ira, great to be on the show.
Thank you. Jonathan Phillips, tell us, facial recognition is already being used in security applications. I mentioned the border control in Australia. Have there been any real problems with that control over there?
I'm not aware of any. Mm-hmm. In fact, my understanding is that the people who use it like it very much. And like it very much. And my other understanding is that it's also a voluntary system. People choose it if it works for them. And if it's a fallback, they then go to through the regular immigration mm-hmm. of being interviewed by an inspector.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask all of you, how many times I mentioned that I remember seeing a figure a couple of years ago that if you're in a big city like London, your picture is being snapped about 40 times a day. Is that number gone up at all? Or New York or any other high population city? How many times a day do you think we're having our pictures taken?
Well, certainly, Ira, there's no doubt that the trend is upwards. What the precise number is, I'm not sure, but one of the major technological developments in our society, which we have to deal with, is the proliferation of what I would call sensing devices, which is different kinds of devices that collect various kinds of information, including our facial image, at sort of a non-technical level. One of the largest sensing networks out there are the 150 million or so people in this country walking around with cell phones that have cameras in them and the ability to take pictures and upload them to the internet and make them instantly available to a wide audience. Mm-hmm. So the numbers are only going to go up, and we have to develop policy and procedures to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, can you get good face data from security cameras? I mean, how?
It depends on the quality of cameras that are installed. They can vary from very low quality cameras where it's hard to get a high quality face to very expensive multi-megapixel cameras, in which case it may be possible to get your face and perform recognition today.
Mm-hmm. How close are we to the day where if I'm walking through Grand Central, let's say, Grand Central Station, or a terrorist is walking through there, that a camera there will be able to pick up the face, recognize it, and put out some sort of alarm?
I would say probably at least 5 years away, if not further.
And what is the backlog for? What, we just don't have the technology to know how to do that yet?
I think there's, well, there's any system like that, there are numerous components. One of them is the system that does face recognition. But the other components is you need to track and track all the people, wait till you get a different image of that person. So you need to be able to follow the people. But also, you need cameras that can move to track. So there's the camera tracking issue. Mm-hmm. And also, you need to be where you can put cameras to get it. Cameras to actually take a high enough quality face recognition picture itself.
Mm-hmm. Alice O2, how much better or worse are humans at face recognition than the machines are doing now?
I think under some conditions, humans are a great deal better. In particular, we're very, very good recognizing the faces of people we know well. But when you really compare the kinds of tasks that a security guard would do with faces you don't know very well, in fact, some of the recent work I've done with Jonathan and the people at NIST has indicated that, you know, head-to-head on some reasonably well-controlled experiments, the algorithms do as well or better than humans, or at least the very best algorithms. Mm-hmm. With probably better images than the kind you were just talking about, and so-called cooperative subjects where people really do stand in front of a camera, I think the algorithms seem to be pretty close to in range.
Mm-hmm. Are we
with
getting,
humans?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Are we getting close to the day where everybody's face will be in a database someplace, and it's just a matter of computing power?
We're close to there already, in that everybody who has a driver's license, their photograph is in a database. Mm-hmm. For chances are, it's a digital photo, which makes it easier, of course, to exchange it, compare it, use it for a variety of purposes. And in fact, a number of the state DMVs for a number of years now have been using the state driver's license photographs, for example, for criminal investigative purposes.
Mm-hmm. And let's say you have the database of photographs. Is this database available commercially? Can I buy that database from somebody who has all these photos?
Not currently the DMV photos. Those mm-hmm. are not available for sale mm-hmm. in that kind of way. But I think it's only a matter of time before those commercial databases are compiled. One of the developments that's underway now is in-store advertising and other digital displays in public that are displaying advertisements, but which also have some various form of facial recognition capability, some of it just to recognize is somebody looking at the ad in order to count for billing purposes, how many people have seen the ad, sometimes to discern the gender of the or race of the viewer in order to display certain ads on that basis. But clearly down the road there in the commercial setting is true facial recognition.
You just described the movie Minority Report, didn't you?
Well, in a way, yes.
He was walking
through. We are indeed heading there. I mean, the other guests have talked about some of the technical problems that exist in terms of fully implementing that vision, but the trends are certainly pointing in that direction.
And what needs to be overcome? The fact you said it was 5 years down the road, but it's just a matter of time, I'm saying to myself, before this you can recognize anybody any place. Would that be a correct statement?
I guess one of the open questions, at least from a vision point of view, is are there fundamental limits to the ability to distinguish between faces beyond, say, just identical twins? Mm-hmm. And we don't know that. We do know, for example, that changing – there's a big difference in performance and how it works between recognizing somebody when they have a nice frontal face that's high resolution and well lit, taken under very cooperative situations, as opposed to images taken outside with a cell phone camera. Mm-hmm. And there are drastic changes in how faces are appear when you take images like that. And at this point, we don't have algorithms to overcome that. And a more fundamental question at this point, we don't know if it is possible to overcome those differences of recognizing under, say, changes in lighting, expression, pose. Mm.
Jamie in Medford, Oregon, welcome to Science Friday.
Yes, good afternoon, Ira. This is a perfect tie into what my question would be regarding your experts there on your panel. I've been told, or I've gleaned through the literature, that the most difficult part of facial recognition is the area that's below your nose and above your chin. And so you would think that you would take the other factors into account, because if the gentleman happens to be scowling at the time that the impression is taken, it would then try to compare it with a picture with a more neutral or actually a smiling aspect. And maybe you should kind of describe how the process works, where the facial recognition works, mm-hmm. The nuts and bolts of it.
Yeah.
And I'll take the answer off the air.
Good suggestion. Jonathan, you want to do that, or?
Yes. So the algorithm starts with an image of a person, and then it finds, for example, it finds the center of the eyes, and from there it warps the face into a nice frontal view. In other words, it corrects for tilt, it may correct for a bit for pose and for size, and from there then it takes generates a set of numbers that describe the face, and some of the numbers may be restricted, for example, for the eyes or the nose, or as the caller said, it could also do basically the mouth the region around the mouth, and in that area it would weight things differently. So because somebody may change an expression, it may not put as much weight around the mouth, and based on these description of numbers, then the computer program or algorithm will compare two faces. And what the numbers represent and how they compare them is probably varies from algorithm to algorithm, and is one of the areas of much research in generating robust facial recognition algorithms.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Also on Twittering, and BNST asks, tweet, how easily could disguises cause the computer mistake me for another person? Or that's an interesting question. I mean, if you wear sunglasses or a mustache, would that confuse the algorithm?
So disguises are likely to prevent you from recognizing who you are. It's much harder to wear a disguise and then the computer to think you're somebody you're not.
Mm-hmm. As this technology matures, as they say on Wall Street, and businesses grow up about facial recognition, is it not beyond thought to think that someday that all these databases might be sold to people who want to sell you things and use your face to find you, or actually to have people who might pay to locate you someplace in the world? Let's say, for $25, we have all these cameras around, and we know where we have your driver's license, facial recognition. If we're not using that, we're using these other methods, and we can find any person, any time of the day, any place in the world. Would that not be possible?
Presumably, that would be determined in part by public policy and by whether the databases are collected by governments or for some other purpose. So maybe Jim's the person to answer that one.
But before you answer that, let me remind everybody that this is Science Friday from NPR News. Jim, do you want to? Jim Dempsey?
Well, Alice is right. The problem is that we don't have that privacy framework or that policy framework fully developed. And I think there are two aspects to this, one of which is we have somewhat of an ongoing public debate about the right to privacy generally and about how it should work in the face of technological change. Privacy in this context meaning not merely what is hidden, but how even publicly displayed information is collected and used to make decisions about people. And we do not have laws on the books that address a lot of this, and mm-hmm. the laws that we do have are in many respects outdated. But the second aspect of it is equally important, I think, which is that the technologists and the people developing the technology should not assume or act as if they are separate from the policy debate. At the Center for Democracy and Technology, for a number of years, we've been promoting a concept called privacy by design, which is gaining some traction, in fact, worldwide, which is the notion that as you are building technologies and as you are developing the business practices for their use, from the get-go, the people building those technologies need to think about the privacy implications, and as they make various choices along the way, need to build privacy or, let's say, fair information practices or the rules for the use of that information, need to build those into the technology itself. You know, Larry Lessig said a number of years ago, code is law. That is the computer code at a very fundamental, almost architectural level, does reflect policy choices, and those need to be made apparent to people.
So you're asking the technologists to do that themselves?
No. I'm asking the technologists to join with privacy advocates and other stakeholders, public policy makers, to work through this on the basis of consultation and dialogue and consensus building. No, it has to be a mutual undertaking.
Mm-hmm. One aspect of facial recognition is in the biometric community, and in biometrics conferences now, there are now segments of the community of researchers who do address privacy issues and their properties that can then be incorporated when systems are designed themselves.
Mm-hmm. And they'll be continuing to develop those. We have to take a break. Let me remind everybody that we're talking about facial recognition this hour and other technologies that might go with it. I'm talking with Alice O'Toole, director of the Face Perception Research Lab, University of Texas at Dallas, Jonathan Phillips, electrical engineer at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, Jim Dempsey, vice president for public policy at the Center for Democracy and Technology in San Francisco. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, and you can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI, or hang out in Second Life. We're going to take a short break and come right back and talk lots more about this. Take your phone calls, 1-800-989-8255. Stay with us. We will be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about face recognition and the technology that makes it possible, the future of it, privacy issues, with my guest, Alice O'Toole. She is at the University of Texas at Dallas. Jonathan Phillips, who's at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Jim Dempsey, who is at the Center for Democracy and Technology in San Francisco. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Alice, how does human facial recognition compare to machine? I know, for example, in fingerprinting, the old-style fingerprinting, people used to look at the pictures and they would compare the swirls and whatever, and computers do it differently with little points on the picture, on the finger. How do people recognize faces different than the algorithms that these computers do?
So probably I'll start by qualifying the fact that the really best face recognition algorithms now are proprietary. So although we may know the history of the development, we're not entirely sure exactly how any of these algorithms work since they're proprietary. But humans definitely process faces or see faces as wholes, which may be a little bit different than the way the algorithms, or at least the history of the algorithms, have proceeded. So humans may be very insensitive to individual features in faces, but may make good use of how those features come together to make a whole. So since we all have the same set of features, we all have two eyes, a nose, a mouth, mm-hmm. arranged in roughly the same configuration, really the perceptual expertise we use to recognize faces involves understanding very, very subtle or coding very subtle relationships between those features yeah. and tying them to what makes particular people unique. So maybe another principle of the code is that we rely on, you know, how a particular face is different from our expected average.
Mm-hmm. when it comes to recognizing people from faces, we all know that you could be behind somebody, right? Say, oh, look, it's Joe. I haven't seen him. I could just see the side of his ear or something, right? And we recognize who that person is. And here the technologists are telling us, well, you know, in a dimly lit place like Grand Central, even looking face on, the computers are not good enough yet in making sure they know who that person is.
Right. And I would, you know, I would point out that the people we recognize as well as you just described are, you know, your brother, your friend, your mother. But in point of real fact, you know, people you've seen one or two pictures of and you're trying to spot, you're not going to get them from the back, from a distance with their ear. you'll really need, you know, a much better look.
Somebody like that.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I always, when I talk to people who do algorithm development, I say you don't really want your algorithms to behave like humans on unfamiliar faces. You want them to behave like humans on familiar faces. And so maybe now the algorithms are good enough to be close to the way humans work with relatively unfamiliar people, but nowhere near as proficient as humans are with a subset of faces that they've seen from many different viewpoints under many different viewing conditions.
Well, could you combine then the humans and the machines to make facial recognition more foolproof? Is there a way to do that?
Yes, we actually have. We've worked a little bit on doing this in recent years with data that have been collected in the NIST competition. So we've done some head-to-head comparisons with humans and machines where both the humans and eight or so algorithms generate estimates of whether or not two pictures are of the same person. And when you combine the strategies used by the algorithms in people, you actually can come very close to perfection, even though the humans aren't perfect by themselves and the algorithms aren't perfect. Mm-hmm. So the concept of fusing judgments across multiple estimates is something that's definitely has a lot of potential for future development.
Jonathan Phillips, the up-and-coming technology we're going to be seeing more of these days is 3D. Can you use, you know, it's going to be in televisions, films, we've seen them already. It's going to be everywhere, I think. Can we use 3D recognition to make it easier to recognize somebody?
So face recognition from 3D images is an active area of research, and also there are some products out there. The advantage that 3D gives you, because you know the entire shape of the face, is to be able to recognize people across pose. So, for example, matching a frontal with a side view, or because you know the lighting direction, the 3D will allow you to compensate for the different lighting directions themselves. So there's a potential to make facial recognition more robust to some of the challenging areas today.
1-800-989-8255. Kathy in Detroit. Hi, Kathy.
Well, hi, Ira. I love your show, and you have a very interesting subject today, as usual. My question for your guest is about the ability of the facial recognition technology to recognize faces as they change over the years, say a photo of an infant versus a teenager, adult, or senior.
Jonathan, any comment on that?
So there's probably, there again, this is a very active research, but there's probably two different areas of aging with face recognition. The first, for example, is going from an infant as somebody grows through adulthood, because there are fixed ways of changing and there is substantial change. The other is for an adult from the age, say from age 20, as they go over in life. And face recognition seems to be relatively stable up to about 5 years, but the challenge is then how do you model or account for people change from, say, 20, from 10 to 20 years or beyond.
Mm-hmm. Don't the police do this all the time with, you know, pictures they put out of people who've disappeared for years?
So people do have techniques for aging a face, but that the new image of somebody who looks older, I know no place where they've gone and said, yes, I've aged this image by 20 years, and that truly does look like this person in 20 years. And there are many factors that can affect aging. Stress, do you smoke? Do you spend a lot of time out in the sun? Have you gained a lot of weight?
All right, Kathy, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, you too.
Jim, let's talk about something really new and interesting called Google Goggles. Google Goggles, you know. What is that, and what is the connection to facial recognition?
Well, Google Goggles is one of the many services that Google has under development, and this is basically an image search and matching capability. Currently does not have facial recognition deployed, precisely because I think Google is pausing over some of the privacy and policy implications. But really, you have to think about, you know, we've all become used to typing in a set of words into a search box and searching on the basis of text. But the changes that are underway in the way we interact with information are much more fundamental than that. And across the board, information that in the past had been technically available but practically obscure is increasingly becoming searchable and retrievable, and is becoming searchable and retrievable on a whole range of parameters, not just typing in, you know, Science Friday. But you, we can search on image, we can search on sound.
Let me go back to that, those two things. I saw a demonstration of it, and what you're saying is that I can go up to a building and take a picture on my smartphone and then tap on it, and it will find out, it will recognize, it will search through a database or whatever algorithm it's doing, it will find out what that picture is.
It'll give you the address. If it's a restaurant, it'll give you reviews of the restaurant.
Wow.
You don't even have to enter the name of the restaurant. You just point your cell phone at it. You can point your cell phone at a building, at a barcode, at a logo, at a product, get product reviews, pricing information, information about the nearest store where you can buy that product. So we need to start thinking about search as occurring across all of these modalities. And a lot of it, of course, is driven by mobile because a lot of this is based upon these incredibly powerful devices that we're carrying with us.
So in theory, as you said, there's no real reason why I couldn't go up to a stranger with my phone and snap that stranger's picture and have it come back with the same kind of data, who that person is.
Exactly. And you know, the whole policy framework and the set of norms that we've created over, let's say, a course of 100 years or 150 years that photography has been in existence says that your face, your image on the street is not something that you have a privacy interest in. Your picture can be taken. Mm-hmm. But by and large, in the past, that image was not easily identifiable, generally speaking, that unless you were a public figure, the photographer had to come up to you and ask what's your name, or had to ask somebody else who knew you what your name was. Mm-hmm. So now that extra step there is being eliminated, and now that relative anonymity that we had in public places, so you know, you had, quote-unquote, no privacy in public places, but you had something else, which was relative anonymity, and now that is being eroded, and we're going to have to grapple with that.
So we don't have anything protecting you from that? In other
words, not really, and that's why I think right now Google has hesitated deploying that capability through the Google Goggles service. They have something else, and other companies have a photo recognition capabilities built into their photo storage and sharing systems, but at least in the case of Google Picasa, you can use photo recognition in terms of searching the photos in your own database, but you can't do it across accounts.
And who is looking into protecting your privacy in public like that?
Well, we've been there have been some efforts. The American Bar Association, now probably going back 10 years, developed a set of guidelines for the use of video cameras in public. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, 9/11 derailed a lot of rational discussion about privacy, and terrorism concerns came to trump and in a way drown out or marginalize efforts to try to seek a balance there. Equally, though, and the one issue that we haven't really, I don't know that anybody is dealing with, is what I call the democratization of surveillance, which is the fact that you've got the commercial capabilities, you've got the governmental capabilities, but also you've got the fact that, as I said before, you've got literally hundreds of millions of people walking around, each individually able to capture images, upload them, and make them searchable and retrievable.
Talking about facial recognition this hour on Science Friday from NPR News. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, and this really is the story of where we live today, isn't it? The personalization, the democratization, everything available to anyone, and by anybody, at any time.
And we've enjoyed huge benefits from this, clearly, so I think even the staunchest privacy advocate would not propose in any way trying to slow down or stop the development of the technology. It's going to continue to add benefits just like GPS does, et cetera. But we do need to think very deeply and broadly, and a lot of people need to be thinking about what are the norms, the new set of norms for the use of this technology.
Also, too, where do you weigh in on this?
I certainly agree with Jim and everything he said. It is, it's definitely a new world with, you know, even things like Google Maps where, you know, you can put down that little man on the map and see your house, which, down to being, you know, we did this recently with our house. You can read the license plate of the car sitting in the driveway with the quality of the map. So
forgot to bring the garbage cans in today.
Right. Right. So, you know, it's and with cell phones and we haven't mentioned Facebook yet, but, you know, that however hundreds of millions of good quality images of people that are there with, you know, minimal or no privacy protection that potentially could end up in databases. So the technology, I guess, always outstrips the thoughts about how to employ it and how to constrain it. But
and this is the technology we only know about. Who knows what DARPA is working on these days or what they're able to do. You know, we were all surprised by global positioning, right? GPS units that have been around for years secretly being used by the government. We only found out about them, you know, in war situation. Who knows how far these secret research projects are going on? Do you suspect they're a lot further along, Jonathan Phillips, along the line than we know about?
I would suspect the latest findings in vision are at the major conferences in computer vision, and going back to concerns is the idea that there are guidelines by policy for privacy for design guidelines or input to the vision community and biometric community about how we ensure privacy or take these considerations in algorithms. I think the community would be welcome to that, a dialogue. So as the technology is developed, there can be also thought about the privacy concerns and considerations that go into this.
Mm-hmm. And are there meetings about this? Did people get together and discuss this?
Occasionally, but not at a level. For example, someone like Jim Dempsey was there to give input, or I'm not aware of computer vision people who are doing research going to conferences on the privacy and the technology side.
Jim, do you think that the war on terror is really putting these issues at the side?
Well, they certainly have in the lawmaking field per se. I think that the technologists, as Jonathan and Alice both say, are almost eager for this kind of engagement. Two problems that have happened, two barriers that we face are, one, the fact that there has been clearly an influx of governmental spending, much of it on the so-called black side, which makes it hard. There's been some outreach even by the intelligence community, but not nearly enough. Even within the intelligence community, people are thinking and worried about the implications of some of the technology that they're developing. And secondly, the issue that Alice mentioned, which is that some of this technology, how it works, is proprietary.
Yeah.
And I think that's a real problem.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there, Jim, because we've run out of time.
Fine.
But that's a good point to leave it on. It is proprietary. We can't even get in and see how it works. Jim Dempsey, I want to thank you. He's Vice President for Public Policy at the Center for Democracy and Technology in San Francisco. Alice O'Toole is Director of the Face Perception Research Lab at the University of Texas at Dallas, also professor in the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences there. Jonathan Phillips, Electrical Engineer at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, Program Manager at their Multiple Biometric Grand Challenge. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Greg Smith.
Thanks, Ira.
You're welcome. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarian Kim Oleski. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can leave us email or whatever. We have a new iPhone app. Yes, there's a Science Friday iPhone app. You can take us with you wherever you go and watch our videos, our video picks of the week, and our podcasts are in there. And now you can listen and watch anytime you'd like to. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.